Right, so welcome back to the Python People podcast, where this week I'm joined, delighted to be joined by my guest, Elena Boyaskaya. Elena, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. How are you?
Yes, I'm all right. Yeah, not too bad. A little bit of a cold, but other than that, I'm in good spirits. I'll
It's the
survive.
season.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Elena, look, I'm really, really excited to have you here today. I know we've obviously had a few conversations in the past, but for those people who haven't yet had the pleasure of making your acquaintance, so you're the head of applied machine learning for Snorkel AI. Snorkel AI, really, really exciting and innovative company. I know you're focused on essentially helping businesses manage their data more effectively in the field of building AI solutions. So essentially, you're building a platform which is streamlining the labeling and organization of data for companies much more quickly. I'm sure you'll do a much better job of explaining it than I, but no, really, really kind of useful service in this day and age that we're all living in with the adoption of AI. So yeah, super excited to hear more about your role and the work that you're doing there. But prior to Snorkel, you've had many other very successful data leadership positions for companies like Databricks and Tempus AI. So yeah, just really keen to hear more about your journey. So let's start at the beginning, shall we? If we may,
sounds good.
Talk us through a bit about your background and your career to date.
Awesome. One thing about me is that I am from Russia originally, so I'm an immigrant. And so that did shape my journey quite a bit, obviously. But, we came to the States. I was about 11. And, the whole goal was to, finish college. Like that was the whole point, right? So that's kind of where I started out. But I went I got a bachelor's in math and economics, double majored. And at the time, my parents were both computer programmers and, kind of that stereotype of a Russian programmer, if you will, in the States, it's kind of a thing. And so I was saying to myself, I'm like, I'm never going to follow their footsteps. Like, I'm not going to code. I'm not going to, I'm not going to be a programmer. Like, I'm not going to be in tech. I'm going to be in math. I'm going to be a mathematician. Like, I love math. That's what I'm going to do. And as my, as I learn more and more about life, I kind of realized like the applied stuff is where you matter more. Like I went from like being super interested in pure math to like learning about statistics to then learning R was my first coding language, which is, applied to statistics. R and statistics really go hand in hand. So that's where I kind of started transitioning over to the applied side of things instead of just being kind of the idealist that I was. Yeah. And so I went to grad school for a PhD in economics, thinking that I'm going to use applied math basically to solve, world hunger and other problems of the sort. And then when I got there, that was about 2007-8. The markets were starting to crash, and if you remember the 2008 market crashes,
yeah,
due to like the housing bubble, and it was a tough time. And in the program, no one was talking about what's going on. Like they were focusing on things that like didn't connect. So I started looking for something else, and I ended up I left with a master's in economics, and I ended up getting a PhD in public health, which used machine learning techniques to identify cardiovascular risk in your accelerometer data. So anybody's accelerometer data, which is being collected on your phone right now, we can apply a machine learning algorithm to get insights out of it, right? Like that is what those companies are now doing, Fitbit and Aura and others.
Yeah.
Well, that was kind of that beginning for me, and identifying like the risk of cardiovascular disease was kind of my labeled data set, if you will. So anyway, that was kind of my academic career, and it could have gone in many directions. I ended up having a connection through my advisor to a company called FINRA, which is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. And they regulate the U.S. stock market, right? So they rebuild the picture of the U.S. stock market daily. They can actually look at the entire trail of from the bid to the offer to what happens to every single transaction. And FINRA monitors the markets. And so that was my kind of first job out of grad school. And I applied my statistical knowledge to a job called psychometrician, which is Like this is back before data science was a term that was used, right? So I did statistical analysis of the tests that FINRA does to regulate the industry. So if you know to be a broker-dealer, you have to pass a test, and so you have to take like a 250-item test, and FINRA has to put out this test and be sure that it's testing the right things, like it's asking you, do you have the right knowledge to work in this industry and to keep the investors' money safe, right? Like we need to test for that for you to become somebody who touches people's money. And so I did the statistical analysis for those exams. And then so this is my kind of bit of career advice of like I knew I want to be a data scientist because I was like really a hot field coming out of I'm seeing it everywhere and I'm like, wait a minute, I have a PhD in machine learning. This has gotta work, you know? And I started doing hackathons, and that's how I kind of became more visible within the company. And as soon as a data science group was formed, I was the first data scientist hired. And I immediately kind of jumped to applying data science machine learning techniques to identifying market fraud in the market in the US stock market based on that enormous data set. So that was kind of like how I made the jump. And so I think we're talking about a little bit of career advice here. I think that was my, how do you become visible to people who are hiring for the roles that you want? So anyway, I'll pause here. Am I kind
Yeah,
of
perfect. That's a genuinely very interesting story as to how you've arrived at where you've got to. So when did you finally realize you're going to follow in the footsteps of your parents and go down the coding route then?
It's so funny. Yeah, so when I was a psychometrician, I was still like, well, I'm a statistician with applied statistics, basically. I'm not a coder. And then I start coding, and that all of a sudden becomes like super valuable. Like I learned SQL, like SQL, I thought it will take like years, the way my parents were talking about relational databases. I'm like, oh, this is just set theory. So like my math knowledge was like, oh, this is just set theory. So that was super straightforward to learn, And then R was like becoming a useful tool. And then it was just kind of like I started building reports using R, and I started like automating my tasks using R. And then it was just like I was super efficient because I could code instead of like clicking around. So I would like write little scripts. I was like, oh, wait a minute. This isn't so bad.
That gets you, doesn't it? But I'm always amazed actually in recruitment how often I see people arrive into the world of tech that have come from this kind of pure math backgrounds and not necessarily intended to go into the world of tech, but they realize obviously there's so much overlap, so much synergy in terms of, being very
Exactly.
analytical, numeric, and actually they kind of, I guess when you have the right mentality combined with the right element of curiosity of actually how technology can help you solve all these problems in a much more efficient and quicker way, then it's a natural route for a lot of people to
Exactly.
start coding and that's it, you never look back, I guess.
It's much easier to get started coding now than before because now you can like leverage your ChatGPT large language model generative AI to help you code. Like if you don't know how to code, you can actually ask and then get started. Like, the worst thing about learning to code is starting with a blank slate and like your IDE and you're, it's blank and it's like, where do I start? So I still to this day like still have to like paste some code somewhere. Like I can't just like write sentence like I start with just that kind of mindset, but it's much easier now. But back then, like I was trying to, this is something that like is pervasive through my career, right? I'm trying to connect the subject matter experts with the thing I'm trying to do. Like I'm trying to build a predictive model of some sort, and I'm trying to get like, well, what is it that we're modeling, right? Like that's what data science and applied statistics and machine learning is all about. Is getting, well, how do we get insights out of data? Well, data scientists themselves like can come up with stuff, but they are not the experts in the data. So we need subject matter experts to help us. And so that's when I started creating like a dashboard for the subject matter experts to then be able to touch the data directly and then kind of help facilitate our conversation because they are not technical enough to actually go in and look at the data, review it. Like they're not writing SQL queries, right? Like they may have a CSV file that they can look through, but there's just needs to be some sort of interaction. So data science is a lot of like creating a dashboard for them and then giving them the opportunity to talk to you about, so this is what I kind of look for and this is how I make decisions about the data. And so that then, and then when I became the data scientist at Finner, the lead data scientist on the market regulation side, I immediately had to learn Python because obviously R, well, maybe not obvious to you, but I'll say, you know, R does not distribute well. Like it doesn't work on large data. And so Python is the obvious choice for the data scientist, which I didn't know up until that point. So I had all the machine learning understanding and knowledge, and I knew how to code in terms of like, you know, if then statements, but like the Python syntax I didn't know. And it was actually like very, I had to learn like immediately, right? Like very quickly, which when you start working with the APIs for machine learning libraries, like it's not difficult to learn. It was just something that was like very clear, like R will not work here. You have to. And I think your podcast has something to do with Python, I believe.
Does indeed, absolutely, not exclusively, but for that reason, that is why it's called the Python People Podcast. Indeed, absolutely. Okay, cool. So talk us through, when did you decide to make that transition from individual contributor to moving into more into leadership? And was that a conscious decision? And yeah, talk us through a little bit about that journey for you.
Yeah, so thank you. That's actually something I'm super passionate about because it's kind of like I really enjoy mentoring people. And so connecting with people has always been something I just do naturally. And so we had like data science talks that we organized during my time at FINRA, and we just connected with people and we would like share ideas. That was the funnest part for me, right? It was not the coding for me. It was the like the discussing papers and kind of like thinking about, you know, the different departments and how they can implement a machine learning algorithms and how they can be successful with data insights. So I ended up, FINRA was a Databricks customer, so I'll just be like super transparent. So as a Databricks customer, I became like enamored with the platform because it was very clearly like what I needed to be successful as a data scientist. I started coding directly against millions of records, like without knowing distributed computing, without knowing how to set up a Spark cluster. You know, all of the barriers to entry that I needed were gone because Databricks had the platform that allowed me to use the data like very directly. I just became such a fan. I moved over there and you know, worked there for a while. I was working and then that's where it like completely shifted from having a data science fraud detection problem that I'm working on, a singular kind of system, to working on a variety of customer use cases. And that became really exciting because it's kind of fast paced. You're doing applied, you know, data science, but you're helping customers and you're not kind of you know, seeing one problem all the time. You're seeing, you know, I started seeing retail problems, I started seeing healthcare problems. Like it was super exciting. And working with customers, well, that was the other piece that I did not have before. So that kind of collaboration with people became really the main part of my like value as a person at Databricks. Like, yes, data science, but also you can like I was on the post sales side, so the customers that came to me were like unhappy, right, with where they are right now, and they had problems, and I helped them with their data science problems, and sometimes it was reviewing their code, which at that point I finally got like a pretty good coder. You know, after a year or so of like learning Python. And then I was like the R expert, de facto R expert in the company. Like people would send me like any R problems, that was me. And then like data science problems. And it was just kind of like, now you start to talk to customers. Now you start seeing their problems. Now you became a guide of like how to use the platform, but also like, is this the best approach to data science and, you know, setting up the machine learning problem? And is this the most scalable way to do it? Is this the most efficient, right? Those conversations became like way more interesting, right? And because they're already solving a problem, but now I get to kind of inject my two cents with my experience. And that was kind of, that's what leadership to me is all about, is kind of guiding people. And so getting a chance to do that with first with customers, right? And then it kind of morphed into actually my time at Tempus is when I got the official chance to lead a team, to actually start a team from scratch and to lead. A team of data scientists, and that came out because of somebody I worked with at Databricks, went to Tempus and called me over to become a the lead, the lead for the solution architecture team. So speaking of other career advice, in my opinion, like building that network and kind of again, just naturally collaborating with people, you form a network, and then that network inevitably comes around and kind of, we're very good friends now. And, just talked to him last night. We're all I'm always I'm still talking to everyone I worked with throughout my career. So it's always it, and not like because I like need them to give me a job. Like it's obviously just kind of a natural collaborative form a relationship kind of thing. So that's kind of the journey. And in between that, by the way, I went to a company called H2O, AI, which is something I went there because it was something I was recommending to all of my customers. So again, like I'm a fan of the product, I'm going to go there kind of thing because H2O was had an open source machine learning algorithms that were distributed. So they easily distributed within a Spark cluster. And so every Databricks customer that was having trouble with a Spark ML algorithm, I would recommend H2O. I was like, and they were getting value out of it. And I was like, well, this is a fantastic little company. And then they miraculously reach out. It's just kind of synergetic. Like they reach out because of my background. And I was like, well, yeah, of course. I've been using you guys for years. I've been using them from FINRA days. And so I was a huge fan of the company. And then the only reason I left was because a person from Databricks went to Tempus, reached out to form the solution architecture team at Tempus.
I see. I see. Nice. Oh, lovely. I mean, I really, really enjoyed listening to the story of kind of how the opportunities have presented themselves, and it feels like there's a definite core theme there. I think you made the point earlier that you're a people person, right? And you love people. And I think in my experience of recruiting quite heavily in the data science market, I find that the better data scientists are the ones that understand what they're doing insofar as how it's solving a problem for the business. And then I think the even better ones are the ones that kind of actually buy into it because it's solving a problem for people, and they buy into the people, and they really are able to build those relationships. And I think the most successful data leaders I've come across have been those that have been able to act as a real conduit between tech and the business because of their people skills and because they are people, and they do, buy into people, and it definitely feels like doors have opened for you on the basis of clearly your ability to
That's
be
right.
that people person and build strong relationships with people, and I guess, like you say, call it serendipity or whatever you will, but what goes around comes around, and I think that's a great
Yeah,
way to hear.
that's true. I was gonna say that my family has always like seen this about me, but I didn't see it until much later. But I thought for me to be successful and my value in the workforce is gonna come from my like very deep knowledge of math and coding or whatever. Statistics. And it turned out that I do have that knowledge, but it turned out that my differentiator is always going to be my people skills, which I actually actively worked on developing. It wasn't something that necessarily came naturally. I have huge anxiety of like talking with people. So I actually like practiced, like went around and practiced talking with people, and just feeling more open around people because I knew like I had a lot of anxiety showing myself to people, if that makes any sense. It's
Absolutely.
getting a little deep, but it's like I had like a hard time just talking to strangers. This is like back in high school and like maybe I was like 16 and I would just get like couldn't even raise my hand in class kind of thing. And I was like, I don't like this about myself. I know that there's more to this than just like accepting that. So I started to, I got a job in probably the thing that drove me to be where I'm at today is I got a job at customer service in a retail company. And like I was 16, I just worked as a cashier and my family's like scratching their head, like, you should focus on your studies. I'm like, no, this is, trust me, this is helping. And I started like just talking with customers. And as I'm checking them out, I just like start to figure out how to make small talk with them and feel natural and not feel so anxious. And Like literally practiced that for a couple of years while I was in high school. And then all of a sudden I have people skills and I can talk to people of any background.
Yeah. Well, you're
So
doing clearly practiced it very well, because you would never know today,
I
right?
just never know, but
Obviously,
I couldn't make a
yeah.
phone call like without just having a complete meltdown. So
Wow. Wow, fantastic. Well, thanks for sharing. And I think that's really inspiring, and also, aligns with another trait that I think the very successful leaders are people that are very self-aware, not sort of ego driven of, I know, well, I'm the leader now, I know everything. And clearly very self-aware at 16 to proactively go and do something about it and work on your perceived weaknesses was
well, it's a bit
very
retrospective.
insightful.
Yeah, I'm a bit retrospectively describing that, but yeah, that there was some conscious decision there because I'm like, well, I don't like the fact that I just literally stay quiet the entire time. I'm in a room with people
Yeah,
and
nice.
people don't know what I'm capable of and I can't like live my life like that.
Yeah. And to the point we're towards talking about now, I guess, of the evolution of AI and how, it is easier in this day and age because we all have access to this inherent layer of logic now, with LLMs and ChatGPT and so on and so forth, that we just didn't have access to back in the day. I think it's becoming even more important that people are able to identify, empathize and work on those people's skills in the world of
Okay.
data now more than ever. Even in the I look back to when I started True North in 2019, and the very first conversations we were having around the data science world then versus data scientists coming into the world of work today, it's a totally different landscape. It's almost a wholly different skill set that people have had to build and develop, and that's within the space of, a few years. So yeah, I think it is a it's a great skill to develop, and I think fair play for doing it. But I'm interested to get your take. What other qualities and traits, do you feel make a great tech leader?
So I firmly believe, and this is something I've experienced throughout my career, like I've seen what good and bad looks like I know what feels good as an individual contributor. So I kind of base it a little bit off of that, right? Because you kind of that's you don't jump into leadership directly, right? You kind of build it up. And so I built up my approach from my experiences with good and bad management, right, in the past. And like what makes me most efficient, what makes me effective, what gives me the spark, what gives me the inspiration to work hard and like go above and beyond, because that's what you ultimately want out of your individual contributors, right? You want them to feel safe, supported, heard, understood, and then they're gonna go above and beyond for you and the company. And it's not like, if I rein in and tell them what to do, they may or may not do it well, but it's like giving them the context and the kind of coaching them to a solution is a lot more interesting. And then it's a lot more likely that they're going to own it next time. And so that is like the core of leadership to me, kind of like developing people, giving them empathy and leading with empathy and giving them the benefit of the doubt that they are actually very, very, very capable, especially the type of people we hire, right? Like they likely have a master's or a PhD in data science or are likely feel like a lot of physicists or chemists come to data science. So they have these huge careers and they have this like wealth of knowledge and maybe not a lot of experience with customer facing things or anything like that, but there's some degree of experience, right? And then they're very, very capable, very smart people. So I give them the benefit of the doubt that they know what they're doing, right? And I just like develop the finesse around it. Does that resonate? Kind of like the fact that we need to give them the tools to be successful.
Totally, absolutely. It massively resonates with me. I mean, it kind of really aligns with exactly my definition of leadership is, I think that you can take it in two ways. I think we've all probably had those more, let's say, stereotypical managers in the past that have been on the power trips and maybe, been in the position of acting out of ego, being a manager. And I've long believed that. And certainly the better leaders that I've worked under and followed have been the people that they're there to help you be the better version of yourself, and I think that's how I look at my job today, is it's not about me going out there and doing the most placements, doing the most deals out of anybody in the business because I'm the managing director of the business. It's how can I help other people be as successful as possible? And by virtue of that, if they're successful, I'm successful, the whole business is successful, and we all go around. And I think it's a new age way of looking at leadership, but one that I totally
Yeah,
believe.
that's where I discovered it to be most impactful as well.
Absolutely. Well, great minds, eh? Well, I love your point about you only go to a company where you love the products, which I guess kind of brings us on to probably talking a little bit about Snorkel then. Great business, like genuinely, huge value offering in terms of what the business does. But talk to us a little bit more about, some of the innovative work you're doing at Snorkel and how it's all panning out for you there.
Yeah, absolutely. I do have to give you the background on how I ended up at Snorkel, by the way, because as a data scientist at FINRA, so my very first data science job, I was looking for ways to label data in the market. And that's a needle in the haystack. How do you find fraud in the US stock market? Luckily, it's not that pervasive that we're, constantly seeing it. So that's great. But it's got a very few labels that we can use to then model the system. And so we were constantly looking for ways to get subject matter input and kind of turn it into features to build a model on top of it. And that was a struggle. Obviously, when I go to a subject matter expert, they can't explain to me exactly how to manipulate the data to put it into to create a feature out of it to then put it, they're giving me their high level understanding, then they get into the weeds and it's just like, how do I code that, right? How do I code that into meaning? This is a difficult problem, right? Definitely kind of looking for fraud is difficult because you don't have too much clarity around it. So at the time, I went to the Databricks conference at Spark Summit, and Snorkel in 2017, I believe, was the keynote. And so Snorkel, their research work before they became a company, Chris Ray, who led the organization, the research team, gave a talk about it's not data is the new oil, it's labeled data is the new oil. And how do you label data? And how do you think about data labeling? And how do you work with SMEs to get them to give you feedback on what you're building, right? And kind of looking at error-guided analysis and breaking out the error modes of the model that you just created to identify where, if you have so many hours of subject matter expert time, you want them targeted to the right things that are going to help you with your system, building your system. So using the error modes of your model, right? And identifying, okay, here the model is really unsure. I need you to look at these three cases and then help me label those. And then we update the labels, we keep iterating on building the model. So that concept was in my mind in 2017 when I was a data scientist working on a fraud use case. And I always respected that and always used that and had that in my head. And then they became a company. And then in about a year ago now, they reached out to me to join Snorkel. We started conversations and I was like, oh, of course I know Snorkel. It wasn't a conversation of what is it that you guys do? It's like, yeah, I'm so glad you became a company. Of course, I'm interested. So what Snorkel does is it's still that, right? But it's kind of facilitating a way to get insights out of your data. So you said so we call it programmatic data labeling. It's kind of a new concept because instead of kind of getting you to build a machine learning model around the data that you have to featureize and then on the few labels that you have to build that model, we have the problem turned on its head and kind of start from a different place. So we have a few labeled data points. That's important, but we want to scale that to the entire data set. And so what we do is build labeling functions. This is where programmatic data labeling comes from. We create little functions that are super simple that we keep building on, and then we combine them into a single label for each data point. So each labeling function covers a separate piece of the space of possible ways to label your data. So it could be like the keyword search through your document. So I'm trying to label my document. Is it a loan document or is it a not loan document? You know, like very simple, but I don't have all of them read, so I can't tell you that. But if the document has the word loan in it, that's a keyword. I can search for that keyword, and that's not a function that is going to give me the correct label every time, but it gives me a weak label. Like that's the idea of weak supervision is where Snorkel kind of started and made its name and became the research work that later turned into the company. So using a bunch of those, so if we keep layering them and then compare them to our ground truth that we have a handful of ground truth labels, we can then identify that there's a model that builds a label per data point. And now I have my entire data set labeled based on some insights from the SMEs. So the SMEs are going to be like, well, obviously, if this word is present in the document, like obviously that's a good start. What else? And then we start building, and then maybe we use word embeddings, and there seems to be a cluster of words that appear to all map to the same label. So we'll use that. There's a variety of modes that we can, and it can be a very custom. So we have a Python SDK, so we can put any sort of code into it that any logic. Encapsulates any logic to build this labeling function. So whatever the subject matter expert is kind of sharing and kind of as we have a conversation with them. So this has a lot of interaction with SMEs. You can't get around that. And we're trying to distill their understanding, their innate understanding of the data into these small labeling functions that we build on to label the entire data set. At that point, we have our original data set that we didn't have to featureize because the featurization happens during the labeling functions process. And then we have our entire data set labeled with these labels that come out of this sort of model that combines labeling functions into a single label. And then we build a simple model that bridges our data to our new labels. And then that model becomes really simple and lightweight. Like we don't have to. This is where my previous companies, like we were focusing on tuning the model. At this stage, we don't have to tune the model as much as we have to just get the labels right. That comes from kind of layering labeling functions on top of labeling functions. And then the model becomes super simple. So a logistic regression is actually going to perform fantastically well. And we almost, and if latency is an important factor for you, you can easily deploy a logistic regression over something super complex and like building your own deep neural network from scratch. Like, don't do that. Rethink the system because, like, if you're using the power of modeling itself to improve performance, that means, you don't have enough labeled data. You're trying to increase power through a different mode versus focusing on the data itself, getting the most out of the data, making sure it's labeled correctly. And then the model becomes super easy. And then there's the error-guided analysis part, and then we identify, okay, you need to iterate more here. Like there's these labeling functions that are not performing well. They're clashing with the model predictions, or they're clashing with your ground truth. Take a look. And so you give your SMEs, here are the three data points I need you to review and make sure, or building your labeling function or whatever. So it's a constant iteration. So that's the product. In a very like technical way, but I do want to make sure it's clear. So I'm a big fan. So in short, yeah, I'm a big fan
I can
because
see
that,
why. You know, it's often you kind of hear about the platform. Sorry, she says. Frog in my throat. Yeah, every so often you kind of hear a platform that just makes so much sense. You know, it's like it's incredibly, I'm sure it's obviously incredibly complex at many layers, but also very simple. Yeah, very powerful in terms of obviously what it does and the way it does it as well. And yeah, I can just see why it would have kind of mass adoption, to be honest. And yeah, I think it's a
Oh,
great
I'm excited
product.
about that. And I'll say too, like, where does Gen AI fit into all of this? So like, and I've heard many times, like, Gen AI solves everything. Well, of course it doesn't, because you still like generate, like it's in the name. It generates a bunch of output of any sort. Like it's a trained model that understands the internet, speaks, many languages, knows all of has all of the knowledge of Wikipedia, so just like this generic knowledge and knows how to talk, it's going to generate output. It can label your data for you, right? So we actually use that as a start, a warm start for our labeling. We ask an LLM to label the data set according to our criteria. So you can write any prompt and it creates a labeling function, just like any of the other ones I described. However, it doesn't do a thorough job because the enterprise data that you're working with is definitely more nuanced than that, right? So it's effectively you're bringing in a college student to label your data and you give them a few hints. They do a mediocre job, and then you start to layer on
Top.
because they don't know the enterprise. Again, like it's not that anybody's stupid. It's just that we need to give you more information. And so those labeling functions, other labeling functions start, the ability to layer them together is where we become really good at creating a complete system. So it's an input, but it certainly is not the only way.
Absolutely. Yeah, it feels like that kind of layering system is it's kind of where it's at. And what do you feel now, having kind of created the product to where it is to date? Where's the next place for Snorkel to go? What sort of areas can this evolve into now?
Yeah, so we're kind of coming into our original data labeling space because, this company, I think it has a very clear like mission where we fit. We help you label data, and it's label data in such a way that doesn't require human input. It requires some coding, but we create a system that's scalable. So that's the main value driver, is that you're not going and sending data overseas to get it labeled by people following a script that you provided. So if this doesn't label it, this, right? And so manual data labeling, very expensive, but also not scalable at all, because as soon as something changes in the way you think about labeling, all of that hard work is gone, right? And you have to redo it. And so here it's programmatic data labeling. It's in the name. You sort of have ways you can switch out these functions. You can keep in iterating on them, integrating them into new ways of thinking about how do you label data. So that's the core. Now the main kind of next step for the company is like, well, where does Gen AI fit into all of this, and how do we help? Because everybody now is like, well, yeah, predictive models, whatever, easy. That's not true. They're still the core business. Like, they're still super important. But Gen AI, everybody's building a chatbot, everybody's building some sort of like agentic, LLM based service, right? That there is something that this generative model does for you. Again, generative, it's in the name. How do you know that the output of this model is any good? How do you know that it's doing what you asked it to? Because it's creating so much output, you cannot possibly have it labeled by a human, right? That defeats the purpose, because the whole point is to replace what the humans are doing. So we need a way to label that, we need a way to monitor, to make sure, to evaluate that the LLMs are actually performing what you asked them to perform. How can you possibly trust them, right? Like without this. So there's still like this labeling aspect. There's still this need for annotation, and there's still a very key part of evaluating the LLM output to make sure that it aligns. And there's multiple facets too. It could be correct, but it could be impolite. It could be improper for your industry. Like, there's so many facets that you can evaluate this LLM on. And so we take the same approach ultimately, is that you have the LLM output, and then you have a few ground truth labels labeled by humans to show the LLM this is what good looks like. And then we can iterate through that and build labeling functions to make sure that we have sort of these models that evaluate the LLM output, so we can catch drift. We can catch, if the LLM is hallucinating ultimately, and also build RAG systems. We also kind of take the same approach. Like, if the LLM is giving you the wrong answer, is it a generation error or is it a retrieval error? And if it's retrieving the wrong information, we can also build a model that says, tune this system to make sure you're getting the right pieces of information for the LLM retrieve, right? So the retrieval and generation are both covered in this kind of iterative approach. But nevertheless, like, yes, you can build the system. You can do it, within 15 minutes, you can build a chatbot, right? It's kind of wild to me, like how little effort it takes. But like, okay, so out of the box, is it doing what you want it to do? Is it talking to your customers the way you want it to talk? Is it leveraging the understanding of your enterprise? Like, there are certain things that are, in the private documents that the LLM was never trained on, right? So you need to embed that into the system. How are you doing that? How are you verifying that it's correct? And so on. So still a labeling problem at
Yeah.
the core.
It's interesting. It's a really interesting kind of intersection between where human input and machine learning come together, I think, in this particular area. But no, but it's fascinating stuff. And I suppose you well, clearly are, very articulate and aware of all of the constraints that are involved around LLMs and other AI solutions where we are today. But what do you, I'm really interested to get your take on, having seen the world evolve so rapidly over the course, blink of an eye over the course of a couple of years, what are you most excited about now in the data science and AI world moving forward, and where you feel technology can go to solve problems for businesses and people?
That. It's interesting because we had like almost like a dark ages in the past few years because we forgot about predictive problems in the industry, right? And all everything got invested into generative AI, and we're kind of swinging the pendulum back, realizing that wait, the problems we had are still there. So I'm really excited to go back problems and actually solve them well, because I think Snorkel has everything that you need. I really believe that, like as far as like as a data scientist for over a decade, like getting your data labeled to then build a simple model rather than a complex model is like that core piece. And then a lot of in enterprises, I've seen so many use cases over my career, right? Like I've worked with every industry and I've seen so many use cases that they're all like rule-based, like there's a rule-based system that I'm trying to basically either generalize or make more efficient or kind of improve upon. That problem is still the key, like to most enterprises getting value out of their data. Because obviously, if they've invested so much into getting, building this rule-based system, and it could be like a SQL query where they just like have if this and this and this and this, then do this, and like this kind of rule-based system. A lot of enterprises have. I mean, most have. And that's because that was the problem they were really trying to solve. Like that's the key to their business. Well, we can convert them into a machine learning model, a simple one at that, using this approach that Snorkel offers. So it's like we can literally take these rules, turn them into labeling functions, build a simple model on top of that. It's still transparent. So transparency is still important to like financial industry, healthcare industry. They care about how the decision is made, and they need to, for compliance reasons and fraud reasons, they need to be able to show how they made the decision. So, us leveraging an LLM still has to be verified, right? So we still kind of have to have that thorough approach. So anyway, kind of getting a predictive model that does things that is interpretable is still the most exciting to me. So getting data insights out of this massive data that you have, and then making sure it's still easy to interpret is like, yeah, that's everything.
I
That's
love that.
the key to your whole to
Yeah, I love that. I think
success.
it's a really, really nice pragmatic answer that rather than looking backwards, let's sort of take a little look back as well, right? And sorry, rather than looking forwards, let's take a look back because, yeah, obviously Gen AI has, I think, for well, the first time in a long, long time, where a technology has had genuine kind of worldwide recognition, whether people necessarily know what it is, but awareness, I suppose, and adoption. And I think it has kind of diverted everyone's attention away from a lot of other areas, right? There's a lot of value still being left on the table, right? And certainly products like Snorkel, where you can not over necessarily need to over engineer a situation and build a lot more kind of elegant solution in a much quicker and efficient way, makes a hell of a lot of sense, right? And Gen AI is not the solution for every problem.
It is a bit like over so you I love the word elegant here, because when you use an LLM to do something that's super simple, like are you sure you need that? We can test if that's the right approach, but are you sure? Or is this actually a predictive problem that can be described with a few regular expressions that we, wrap into a labeling function. Anyway, agreeing with you.
Cool. Good to know. Good to know. Well, bearing in mind, I suppose we're both acknowledging that the data and AI landscape has evolved substantially and really progressed forward in these last few years. We talked a little bit about the skill set of people coming into the market today. Just really interested to get your thoughts as a leader on if the skill set is evolving technically, are there particular characteristics and traits within people that are important to you when hiring for quality data and tech professionals into your business? What do you look for? How do you evaluate candidates in that regard?
Yeah, so this is really important. You and I were just chatting about this. The LLM stuff that's taken over, right? So the generative AI, it's very NLP based too. So that's part of a very important part of your technical knowledge, but there is this foundational knowledge that I'm seeing now candidates are missing. They're going in and getting certificates in directly in like Gen AI, but they're not familiar as much with like your classic predictive machine learning techniques. And the classic machine learning techniques are actually just statistical models. Like they're, you know what I mean? Like they're rebranded, but they're certainly just basic statistical models to an understanding like how a regression works. Oh, by the way, LLMs are based on regression models that are combined into neural networks that are combined, they're very complex, but the core of them is still a regression model. And so understanding regression models and kind of vector analysis and those kind of like core pieces is very important in my opinion, because you can't evaluate if something is working well without that core knowledge. Like sometimes you jump so far ahead and like throw everything at the LLM without seeing like actually there's a very straightforward fundamental solution that you might miss. And so it's really, really important to, if you're a data scientist, like I'm assuming a very core knowledge of like statistics, machine learning to classical now called machine learning techniques. Before they were just machine learning techniques, now they're classical. Okay. blows my mind. But like then we had like this moment of like neural networks and like PyTorch everything and like Keras and PyTorch and build my own deep learning network and have GPUs. Like that was a thing. And then they become pre-trained LLMs. So we got BERT models that turned into, that's a small LLM. BERT model is still an LLM, right? It's a generative model. And then we have now these bigger and bigger, longer context window large language models. But like they're not separate from the lowly classical regression, that like so kind of understanding where they come from and how they're still neural networks, and how else to how else to build a successful system without that knowledge, foundational knowledge. So that's one. So just kind of not forgetting that. I do see Python coding as something that's just like fundamental. As wrong as I was as a young statistician thinking I don't need to code, I immediately saw the need for it, because you can't really so here more and more being like a fantastic coder really sets people apart, because ultimately you're going to have to code. Can you do it efficiently? Can you do it fast? Like, are you comfortable doing it versus like it's dragging your feet through mud. So that's really kind of important. That's like foundational stuff, And then the ability, you touched upon this actually at the beginning, of like understanding the business problem and the value that you're bringing by building this cool algorithm. Like I see people sometimes over-index on the cool solution, and I'm the boring person who's like, maybe this is just a regression model. Like again, you sometimes see it's a lot more inspiring maybe to build something complex to somebody who's like super technical, super smart. And then when it comes to the type of work that we do to bring value to the company that we're working with, like to our customers, we need to understand what value we're bringing them. And so if we build a cool model that doesn't solve a problem, like we just wasted a bunch of time and resources. We can't do that. We can't, no one can afford that, right? So we definitely want that like understanding of what am I doing here? That takes some conversation with the customer to understand how you're bringing them value, which comes back to people skills. Like Because if you're just letting them, this is the worst. I see kind of the worst approach that happens a lot to us is we end up being told by the customer what they think they want and us unable to guide them to a solution that is actually better for them. And that's like that finesse that we need. So being able to guide a customer, so get to know their problem and then be able to guide them to the right solution that's appropriate for them, because ultimately we want their model in production because that's a su that's success to us. Like they're getting value out of their data. They have a production model that we built. That's success. And so when we see them coming to us and saying this, and it's just like all over the place, and we're unable to kind of guide them to a solution or take a step by step or whatever, like ultimately the project won't be successful, right? Because we're just doing what we're asked rather than being the guides that we are with our years of experience. And so it's extremely important to be, no, you d yeah, like I said in the beginning, it this is possible to develop. It's not something, I'm able to develop this in people that I hire because I know how I've developed it in myself. Like it's not a skill you're born with. Like understanding business value is not something you are born with. But
No.
it is a mindset that you develop, and it is possible to develop. But I do look for that spark of at least being interested in, getting to know your customer, getting to know their problem, not just being like, just tell me what to do, I'll do it. Like that's a non-starter.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's really refreshing to hear that it kind of, in many ways, still comes back to people, the person, the attitude, which I totally agree with. You know, when we're assessing candidates and what is such a rapidly evolving landscape, sometimes as long as people have that curiosity, to really understand, that's kind of as much as you can ask for, isn't it?
If I may, actually, that's a great point because we are looking for ways. How do you enable a whole team on something that's rapidly evolving, right? Like, I'm not expecting my team to come in with a base level understanding of generative AI. Not everyone has had their hands on, building projects with, like, how can I hire for that, So we're looking at enablement and on how to do generative AI for, again, at the enterprise level that you can put in production. Like, that's not a pet project, right? Like we're solving real problems here. So the curiosity, the ability to see what's out there and understand and try it and like kind of be scanning the landscape and saying, oh, this cool model came out, I'm going to try it out. That is super, super key. I agree. Like that curiosity of the customer and also like, hey, there's this cool stuff out there. What is it all about? And then does it, and then making sure you can understand, does it fit what I'm trying to do? That's the people piece. Like, does it actually fit
Absolutely.
the problem?
Absolutely, yeah. I think one of the biggest key differentiators I see of companies that really get this right is some companies will hire for people that have solved a particular problem that is relevant to their domain. Like, we need people that have this experience in this area. Whereas I think a lot of companies that really get it right are people that they hire for prolific problem solvers. So not necessarily in that particular problem, that particular domain. It's someone that is curious to go, how does that work? And think of
Love
a
that.
solution to it. And the people that have got that proven track record to, jumping into a new domain and getting the lay of the landscape and actually coming up with a, like I say, an efficient, elegant solution quickly. That's the kind of the world I see now in terms of talent and the kind of
Completely.
skill sets that I feel people should be evolving and sculpting moving forward. So totally agree with you there. Perfect. Well, Elaine, look, really, really enjoyed the chat today. I think it's been a fantastic conversation and huge amount of value shared. But I like to draw to a close with every podcast with the same question, if you care to indulge me, which is what is your one favorite piece of advice that you've received throughout your career that you would care to pass on to your fellow human? What would that be for you?
Oh man. Can I start with one that threw me off center for a second?
Please, please do.
I was told I promise I'll bring it back to the point. So I was told as a young PhD student that no one wants the opinion of a 40-year-old woman in the industry. This is something that discouraged me for years. I'm still kind of dealing with that because it was somebody I admire as a woman. who said this to me, and she was in academia, and she was in academia, she said, by choice, because she doesn't think anybody would want her opinion as a 40-year-old woman in the industry. And I kind of took that with me, and I was going to be in academia for my entire life based on that statement. So the best career advice I got from a mentor of mine who is also a woman, who just told me to keep the spark and be myself. I mean, obviously, like, it's really hard to show yourself at work, like who you truly are at work. It's very like, it's almost like you're different people at work and at home sometimes, because obviously. But like, how do I be myself and trust that, my opinion and I have value, and that my opinion matters. So that was, she really encouraged me to, first of all, mentor other women in this, STEM field. Like, it's not easy. And then how do women show up, and be effective in this workplace that is very obviously male dominated? And, it's just like, where does my opinion fit in here? And so it ends up coming down to being very people centric, because that's kind of, it's not a female trait necessarily. It's just something that, like, my curiosity and my spark come from my interactions with people, and me understanding the people and their problems obviously helps me bring them the value. And that's kind of, yeah, if you just follow that, you're gonna be valuable, right? And so I'm just kind of working through, like, well, why wouldn't somebody want my opinion as I approach 40, right? Like,
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think because you're looking at it through the right lens, right? And I totally agree. One of the My
yeah.
dad gave me one piece of advice. He was an independent financial advisor, but different industry, but definitely rings true with what you said. I think he stole it from Earl Nightingale, but was basically all you need to do in life is find out what people want and help them get it, right? And it's exactly.
In a nutshell, and it's not going to be from you being soup, the most technical person in the room who can't talk to people, which was like where I was headed. Completely where I was headed. But I couldn't communicate in with them. So yeah, that came down to be the differentiator for me.
Nice. Well, look, I think a fantastic way to end the show. And again, thank you for coming on. Really, really enjoyed the conversation. And please do come back again, see us at some point in the future. I would love to hear more about how you're getting on and where Snorkel is. I'm sure going from strength to strength. So yeah, we'll speak to you soon, hopefully.
Appreciate it. Good to see you.
Take care.
Enjoyed it very much. Bye.
Subscribe today and never miss an episode.